This is the Country Hour with Megan Hughes on ABC Radio Queensland.
Good afternoon. Thank you for your company. I'm going to start today's show in Western Queensland, specifically talking about the Great Artesian Basin. It's one of the largest underground water reservoirs in the world. To give you some scope of just how big it is, it lies beneath parts of Queensland, the Northern Territory, New South Wales, and South Australia. It spans 1.7 million square kilometres, which is over one-fifth of the Australian continent, and has enough water to fill the Sydney Harbour 130,000 times. And for people in the outback, it's a crucial water source for homes and livestock. But there's a change afoot in Western Queensland because some graziers are starting to grow fodder crops to feed their livestock, and they need reliable access to this water for irrigation. To get a water licence, though, is almost impossible. But now the plan that manages those licences is under review. Madeline McCosker has this story.
Looking out across Scott Holcomb's sorghum crop, you'd be forgiven for thinking you were standing smack bang in the middle of southern Queensland's cropping country. But it's not. His 4,000-hectare dryland crop is in the heart of outback Queensland's cattle country, 1,400 kilometres northwest of Brisbane, near the small outpost town of Caulfield. This country is known for its wide Mitchell grass plains, variable seasonal conditions, and long, hard droughts. But Mr. Holcomb has been able to transform what he describes as his most unproductive country into his most abundant by growing sorghum. He's been growing the crop for about 7 years now to feed his cattle, and he'd like to expand it by accessing water from the Great Artesian Basin.
If we could get access to water from the Great Artesian Basin and put pivots and things like that in, that would be game-changing in a very positive direction.
The dryland sorghum relies on rainfall during the wet season from November to April to replenish soil moisture so it can survive during the dry season. Mr. Holcomb wants to be able to irrigate during the drier months, not just to expand the size of the crop, but to also improve its quality as its nutritional value declines without water.
To irrigate in the winter is the perfect time to do it because we don't have the huge evaporation in that time of year, opposed to the summer. Plus, you're getting rain in the summer, so, you know, you don't really need it then.
Mr. Holcomb says it would not only be a game changer for him, but it could also advance the wider cropping industry across the West.
The hardest thing is getting the soil, and we've got the soil. You just have to add water. So, you know, what that would do for the towns would be astronomical. There's huge potential in all areas.
The Great Artesian Basin holds about 65 million gigalitres of water underground, and for landholders to get even a drop of that, they need a licence. In Queensland, they're allocated and managed through the state government's water department. There's different types too. Stock and domestic licences are the most common, used by graziers to ensure their stock and homes have water. Department of Water Southern Region Executive Director Hamish Butler explains how it works for irrigation.
When it comes to water licences for other activities like irrigation, water licences cannot generally be granted. However, there are provisions in the water plan to trade water entitlements for irrigation purposes between landholders. It just allows water to move around in various areas towards the activities where people need it most.
In comparison, there's about 6,500 stock and domestic licences, but for irrigation, there's only 21. They also have a volumetric limit on them. The Great Artesian Basin and other regional aquifers water plan, also known as Gabora, that licences are granted through, is under review, with the new plan expected to come into effect from late 2027. As the cropping industry expands into new areas, Mr. Butler says interest in water allocations is growing.
We are seeing a need to open up that trading framework. The Gabora water plan is currently under review and is being replaced. And that part of that process, the department is going to look at the trading rules to see if they are appropriate or if more flexibility can be introduced. So all of those rules and regulations and the way that GAB is managed currently is really up for review. And that'll be part of the next sort of year to 2 years work we'll do with a whole range of technical studies, but also engagement with the community to understand and we might get the right balance there.
Back on Scott Holcomb's property, he says his stock are still putting on more weight from eating sorghum than they would had they been eating grass during the dry season.
And we're getting weight gains of 1.2 on a mob of steers. It's just game changing. We're in a sort of a weight gain business and we're summer rainfall, and come around July, a lot of our weight gain has starts to run out. You know, it starts getting down around that 0.3, 0.4 sort of a game. And then when you get down to September, it's sort of right down around 0.2 if you're not assisting with feed supplements.
For Mr. Holcomb, having access to nutrient-rich sorghum year-round would certainly help push his business forward.
If you get a really good season, you know, you can grow sorghum 3 metres high and that thick you can't walk into it. And when it doesn't rain, you don't grow anything.
Scott Holcomb, who is a Caulfield farmer and grazier, ending that report from Madeline McCosker. And you can read more on this story online at the ABC Rural website. Up next, all things tropical agriculture.
Whether you're clocking in, clocking off, or the alarm clock is going off, join your local ABC team when the sun rises each weekday. Join us for breakfast, weekday mornings, right here on ABC Local Radio.
On your radio, online, and on the ABC Listen app. This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
Some of the brightest minds from around the globe are gathered in Brisbane for the next 3 days to discuss the future of tropical agriculture and also provide solutions to meet a lot of the challenges ahead to keep the world fed. This is everything from ancient indigenous grains to artificial intelligence. It's all on the table. I'm actually a bit envious I'm not there. It sounds like an incredible lineup of speakers. I had a look at the program this morning. It seems like it'll be a really, really interesting conference. But Jennifer Nichols from our team, from the Queensland Country Hour team, joins me from day one of TropAg 2025.
And what a day it's going to be, Megan. I'm here at TropAg 2025 and there are over 1,000 delegates and 53 countries represented here, which is just huge. It will run for 3 days, bringing some of the leading scientific experts, agriculture industry leaders, researchers, producers, and other key stakeholders together. And here with me, I have Professor Matthew Morrell, who is the director of the Queensland Alliance for Agriculture and Food Innovation, or QAFI, and we'll get him to give us a rundown of just what we can expect.
Well, thank you very much. Look, TropAg is a fantastic opportunity for researchers and industry and producers to get together and talk about the future of agriculture here in Queensland, but also we have a focus on the global tropics and subtropics, which are often not covered very well in agricultural research conferences. So this is our particular opportunity to bring all those players together to talk about exciting things in agriculture and food. We're very excited to have ACR as one of the key partners. So that's the Australian Centre for International Agricultural Research. And they've helped us bring a lot of staff and students from a variety of countries in our region to this conference. So this is where we can really help our near neighbours meet their challenges. So we really appreciate that support from ACR. So we have three major areas: future foods, growing agriculture, and climate and sustainability. How we can use our agricultural produce to create and to drive more innovation in our food industry. Of course, how to grow agriculture, both in terms of scale, but also in terms of the value of what we produce. And then, of course, we're focusing on the challenges of climate and sustainability. So they're interconnected issues, And so we hope that our delegates will move across between those seams and think about the whole system that we're working with. Look, agriculture is a fantastic area because we have all the developments in science going on in the world. Everyone's aware of the AI revolution. We have opportunities in quantum computing, quantum sensors. We have the genomics revolution, which has been going on for some time. We have, you know, the developments in remote sensing and our ability to take information through to the farmer's smartphone and help predict what actions that farmer should take in order to maximise their production. So we're trying to bring all that together in this conference.
When people talk about the future, it can often get quite bleak, and we have seen some horrendous extremes of weather in Australia in recent years. But what hope is there, do you think, when you think about all these brilliant minds coming together to look at solutions?
When we look at the predictions of climate change, sure, we're going to see some shifts in the regions in which we currently produce compared to where we produce in the future. But we're not just sitting here as a sitting duck. We can, through our breeding programs and our agronomic practices as farmers, anticipate the future and develop varieties which can tolerate heat, can tolerate climate variability better. You know, that's part of the opportunity, is to use that ability to foresee the future and to build that into the kind of research that we're doing now and the advice we give farmers. So climate variability, that is a difficult one, because often when people think climate change, it's a total change in the amount of rain or the heat, but it's really the unpredictability, and that's what we have to help to find solutions to overcome. You know, I think in Australia we have demonstrated over the last 100 years that we're able to adapt to, you know, very harsh climates. We have ancient soils, we have tyrannies of distance in what we're doing, and so we have a lot of innovation, a lot of learnings that we can pass on. So this is one of the great things about TropAg, is it's a melting pot of ideas and experience. One of the things that really excites me is that we're bringing together a number of technologies that have been individually developed. So the ability to model the way plants grow, and then to combine that with the genetic information that we have, and then to combine that with things like remote sensing from satellites, so that, you know, from space we can understand what our wheat crop or our sorghum crop is doing, how much it's going to yield, where it's going to be grown in the future. This kind of science really excites me because of the integration and the practical use of that science.
And how are farmers using this in terms of planning for the future?
Look, they need to choose which crop to sow, when to sow it, how much fertilizer to use, you know, do I irrigate or not, and when do I irrigate? So all of these practical decisions can be aided by these technologies. And as we change the varieties, maybe they need a slightly different program to the ones that they were used to before. So this is where that integration of knowledge is really important.
And what are some of the examples of research that QAFI has already been doing that are really already making differences?
Well, we work across crops, animal science, horticulture, and also food science. One project area I love is our Northern Genomics Program, where we've worked with farmers right across Northern Australia and taken DNA samples from 58,000 cattle and used that to predict the breeding values of those cattle and then feed that back through our partners to the industry so they can predict better performing cattle for the future. So that's a real partnership between producers and the scientists, and then we can feed that back directly, and that can help their bottom line by producing better performing animals. So that's the kind of science we love to do. It's great science. It challenges our staff and students to do that, but then it gives a really tangible bottom line benefit back to the producer.
And you're developing Indigenous links as well?
We're very keen to be involved in a respectful and beneficial conversation with our Indigenous communities around our native flora. to help provide economic opportunity and to work with them to develop skills. So we have a number of really exciting projects at the University of Queensland and across the universities attending this conference to work with communities, working ethically and respectfully to help them to take their opportunities forward.
Professor Matthew Morrell, Director of QAFI, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it.
It's my pleasure.
Thank you, Jen. We're looking forward to hearing about some of those researchers you'll be talking to in the coming weeks. It is 20 minutes past 12. Just to some breaking news now, Australia's Ag and Vet Chemicals Regulator has suspended approval for the use of dimethylwaite on blueberries, raspberries and blackberries. So the Australian Pesticides and Veterinary Medicines Authority, also known as the APVMA, has confirmed its final decision today after announcing the proposal in August this year. No other chemicals used on blueberries, raspberries or blackberries require regulatory action at this stage. And I'll bring you more information on this as it comes to light.
On your radio, online and on the ABC Listen app, this is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
Heading overseas now, because Australian farmers are going to be watching closely as the government of the biggest buyer of Aussie beef says it will investigate what it's calling collusion in the meat industry. United States President Donald Trump has called for the investigation, saying beef processors are driving up prices through illicit collusion, price fixing and price manipulation, that is, jeopardising the nation's food supply. Here's how American media is reporting the news.
President Trump ordering a DOJ investigation into foreign meat packers, accusing them of inflating U.S. beef prices.
President Trump accusing four of the biggest meat packing companies of driving up U.S. beef prices, which hit record highs in August.
Really expensive right now right. At the grocery store. The president now looking into it. You could say he has beef with this particular industry here by looking into what he's calling illicit collusion, price fixing and price manipulation against companies that pack America's meat.
Beef is a big part of the freedom in this country, and I always say where there is beef, there is freedom, and that's what I believe.
I agree.
But analysts are questioning whether America's expensive beef is the fault of the meat packers. Warwick Long spoke to Simon Quilty from Global AgriTrends, who says he doesn't agree with President Trump.
Really, Warwick, I don't believe that's the case, because reality is that meat processing companies in America have been losing near on $270 per animal since February this year. So if it's collusion, then it's collusion on how to lose money, which doesn't make sense. So no, to me, it's reaching out, looking to blame someone for effectively what a very high retail prices. So what it's a pretty simple equation, Warwick. If you look at the value of beef and in terms of cattle and the price rise that we've seen over the last year, which is 22 to 32%, depending on the month, and you look at what we've seen in terms of retail on wholesale prices, retail's only up 8.3% in that same period. Wholesale's up, probably closer to 17%. So the sums don't add up. There's simply not enough cattle in the system.
President Trump was elected on the basis of, well, partly because grocery prices were going up, and he said he could lower them. Meat prices have continued to go up, so he's looking for someone to blame. He says it's the meat packing companies, but you're saying the data doesn't support that.
No, I mean, the July figures came out on their herd inventory. They started collecting those in the mid-70s, and it's the lowest ever since the mid-70s, came in at 94.2 million. So, Warwick, it's just fundamentals. They've depleted their herd for the last, 3 to 4 years due to very severe drought. So this is just a demand and supply problem.
Let's have a look then at the state of the US meat industry at the moment. Four large companies dominate 85% of beef processing in America. That's part of what the president wants to look at there. But you say all four are currently losing money.
They are, and this isn't the first year this is the case. So let's look at the largest, which is Tyson Foods, Warwick. And last year, in 2024, they lost the equivalent of $587 million Australian. And the year before, they lost $140 million Australian. And this year, they're predicted to lose probably in excess of $600 million Australian. So, you know, what's very clear is that when you simply do not have the supply and you're trying to maintain workers plus high input costs, Warwick, the sums simply don't add up at the moment for a US beef processor.
So there's four major players. So Tyson's a big one there. Who else is there? Are they American-owned like Tyson, or are they international companies?
No, you've got basically Cargill and Tyson's are the two US companies, and then you've got JBS and National Foods, which are effectively Brazilian-owned. So you've got South America, North America ownership dominating the market, and trust me, if they could make a dollar, they would be. There is no collusion given these enormous losses.
And JBS and Cargill are the two biggest beef processors in Australia as well, two of those four companies, which brings me to really the point I had in contacting you today, Simon Quilty, and that is, if this investigation's going on in the United States, what could happen from it, and what could it mean for Australian meat companies and farmers who are currently supplying that market in a big way?
Look, I think it not a great deal. I think that the fundamentals don't change. I think Australia will move into a rebuild itself next year. We've got Brazil about to move into a rebuild. The USDA released figures only last week, Warwick, talking of a 400,000-ton shortage globally of beef next year. So this problem is to be potentially repeated in other countries as supply gets tighter and tighter and rebuilds occur across three of the major suppliers. So do I see any fundamental changes? No. I see real challenges. But fortunately, each of these processors have deep pockets. They've been here before. They know that this is part of the cattle cycle globally. And Warwick, I just see actually very good pricing for cattle producers across those three countries for the next 2 to 3 years.
So that's interesting, looking at the market conditions with the United States president, who rightly or wrongly has been seen as quite unpredictable for markets. You think with those conditions, Australian farmers are largely insulated from what may be decided across the shores in what has been our biggest market of late?
I think so. And part of that is not just pricing within North America, but the needs of all the other markets, whether it's Japan, Korea, China. They are all reliant upon, you know, Australia, America and Brazil for supply. And when all three countries are tight, there's only one thing that happens. Prices globally will move higher here.
And last time the president said he wanted to do something about beef prices, you rightly predicted he was going to look towards Argentina. He says he's going to let in more Argentinian beef. Are there things you're watching now as a result of this? Are there more levers you expect the US administration to pull?
I think there is, Warwick. The obvious one is Brazil and dropping the 50% quota or tariff, I should say, going in, that would then make that lean beef for their need for hamburgers much more cost effective. That's from an Australian point of view, one to watch. I really think they're running out of options, though, in terms of finding ways and means and mechanisms to lower prices. Simply, there is too much demand and not enough supply.
Simon Quilty from Global Agri Trends speaking to Warwick Long.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
I'll take you back home now because regional Queenslanders who are wanting to make sure they're prepared for the challenges of drought are being encouraged to apply for a newly launched Future Drought Fund Communities Program. $36 million in grants are available, and that ranges from $50,000 to $150,000. Nina O'Brien from the Foundation for Rural and Regional Renewal says the goal is to strengthen social resilience to help combat the many problems that can arise from droughts across Australia.
The program really is more than just grants. It includes opportunities to participate in leadership skill development, in addition to mentoring as well, delivered by our partners, the Australian Rural Leadership Foundation. So it's fantastic to be continuing our work with them and really strengthening and deepening this work that we've been doing for some 5 years now.
So there's a few things on offer there, not just the grants, but also those other programs that you were talking about. What might the grant money be used for locally? What kind of things are you hoping that funding will go towards?
So we recognise that drought has a range of impacts right across the community, both economically, financially and socially. But these grants really are focused on mitigating some of the social outcomes that occur beyond the farm gate. Our experience tells us and evidence shows that strong networks really help communities adapt more effectively and be better connected and recover from droughts in the longer term. So really practical things that help communities come together to build the social fabric of communities. So it could be things like mental health workshops, can be drought education sessions, things like water saving workshops or community gardens. We've also funded things like youth leadership events, women's gatherings, festivals, whole range of really interesting interventions and supports. What we're really looking for is local ideas that make a difference at a local level. We're very much a fan of working from the ground up. We know that drought manifests really differently, particularly in your part of the world. It's, you know, completely different to say Southern Australia or even Western Australia. So we're looking for really unique, locally designed project that will respond to local community need.
Yeah, that's interesting you were saying there about the importance of social cohesion and, I guess, mental health. Have you seen many examples of that, of how improving social cohesion can help communities better respond to drought?
Yeah, absolutely. And mental health awareness. When we say mental health, we mean that in the broadest possible sense. So, you know, deep social connection opportunities. When we say mental health and social connection, that can be a community festival. It can be, you know, a local workshop. It can be, you know, a women's gathering. Can be a multicultural event, you know, really diverse. But really, it's about building those strong social connections and ties. So when things do get tough, people have strong networks around them, both at a family level, but also at a community level as well, so that communities can navigate some of those challenges together. And that, whether you're talking about, you know, disruptions like drought or other climatic impacts, floods, storms, you know, significant events in the community, that really pays positive dividends, you know, right across the board.
And we've seen a very dry year down at the south of Australia. Have you been hearing much from farmers at all about what they're going through or how they try to stay prepared for a drought?
Yeah, we're seeing some really interesting ways that communities are responding, and keeping in mind this program is focused really directly on the broader community. We know that drought has significant impacts beyond the farm gate, and so that's why this support is specifically designed for that. Yes, absolutely. We, you know, goodness, regional community people are very passionate about their communities, and we talk to them every day on the phone. And we hear, particularly, we had a webinar of 230-odd people yesterday, and we heard much community feedback around the importance of communities being supported through both in drought conditions but to prepare for the future as well. So we're very sensitive to that, and we very much try to adapt the approach so it meets local conditions, because we know that varies. It's still incredibly dry in South Australia. I was looking at the drought indicator map for New South Wales this morning, you know, around the snowy Monaro region is incredibly sort of dry patch through there as well. I live in southwestern New South Wales. We're in drought conditions at the moment, according to that map. So, yes, we know that varies significantly and can turn quite quickly as well.
Yeah, I wonder, has your approach changed at all over the years with how to deal or prepare for drought?
I think historically, we started the very concept of the Future Drought Fund is really positive in that it's recognising that droughts are an ongoing feature of the Australian landscape and an ongoing feature of the types of impacts that will affect regional communities. And so while historically we've seen significant sort of injections of in-drought support, I think very much, and with the advent of the Future Drought Fund, we're working towards taking the much longer-term view of we know that droughts are inevitable and we need to plan ahead. And I think the Future Drought Fund's incredibly innovative in that regard, in that it does take that long-term view of how do we need to set our communities up, how do we need to set our farms up, how do we need to be smarter with, utilising water and resources so that we can plan ahead for that potential increasing dryness.
That was Nina O'Brien, who is the Disaster Resilience and Recovery Leader from the Foundation for Rural Regional Renewal, speaking to Claudia Sullivan. Weather's up next.
The Assembly.
What would your dying wish be?
Endgame with Tony Armstrong, Annabelle Crabb's Civic Duty, and I Was Actually There.
The smoke itself was igniting.
All these and more. Always free, always compelling. ABC iView.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
It's time to check in on the weather, and Baden Gilbert joins me now from the Bureau of Meteorology. Good afternoon, Baden.
Good afternoon. Hope you're having a good Tuesday.
I hope you are too. So what can people expect in coming days in Queensland?
Yeah, so for today and tomorrow and the next day, really a pretty simple story for most of Queensland. On the satellite at the moment, we've got some cloud about eastern Queensland as well as parts of the Central Highlands. A few little showers starting to pop up in that just inland of Mackay and roughly between Bowen and Proserpine. But broadly, just some isolated showers along the northern and central coasts. Maybe taking a little bit more scattered about Weipa and the northern peninsula. As we go into tomorrow, it's a pretty similar story, but then Thursday we start to see storms extend through the northern interior into the central interior. And then from there for Friday, we'll see that ramp up a little bit more, particularly for the southern interior in towards the Darling Downs. By the time we get to the weekend, rain forecast or showers across much of the state. So there is a bit of a wetter signal coming up for the weekend yet again.
And with these sort of storms and showers happening over the next couple of days, any big totals?
In terms of totals for the next couple of days, pretty light for Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. And the storms or showers, if you did get them, would be pretty few and far between. As we go into the weekend, we could see some more decent falls about the Darling Downs around that 20 to 30 millimetre mark and extending into some areas around that as well. Again, as we go into Saturday, maybe picking up a little bit more about the northwest of the state before probably Sunday looking like the wettest day really in a band from the Gulf Country right down towards the Wide Bay Burnett and the southeast of the state. Could see some pretty decent moderate falls before it all moves towards the coast next Monday. So still a little bit of time between now and then, but that's what we're watching for the coming week.
It sounds pretty coastal. What's happening in inland parts?
So for the interior, starting off, in the short term, it's going to be more far north Queensland, northern coast, extending into the northern and central interior on Thursday. And then, Darling Downs for Friday before Saturday and Sunday could be decent totals from the northwest, central west, Longreach, right down through Roma and Charleville towards Miles and the Darling Downs, potentially in for some moderate falls in the weekend.
And like along those coastal areas, is there any impact on wind and swells?
In terms of our winds and swells for the coming days, I don't have anything too amazingly big to report. There are still some lighter trade winds in play for northern and far northern Queensland at the moment. As we go into the back half of the week, we could see a bit more of a northeasterly flow develop, turning more northerly into the weekend, particularly about the central and southern coasts of the state, but they're not bringing any significant swells with them, really.
And in regards to temperatures?
Yes, so for temperatures, we're actually sitting a little bit below average for parts of southern Queensland over the next day or two, both in the minimums and the maximums. Meanwhile, as we get some of the shower activity come into the Northern Cape, we might finally see an easing in those maximum temperatures up there, which should hopefully bring us back out of a severe heatwave warning, which has been going up there for quite a little while now during the build-up. So some good news up there with some relief in temperatures on the way. Otherwise, bit of a mixed bag really into the end of the week. Maybe a bit of a pick up about eastern Queensland on Saturday before some cooler temps through the interior on Sunday.
What's driving this weather at the moment? I just thinking back to last October and sort of November period, it was very hot. So it just seems a bit strange that this one is not as warm.
Yeah, we've definitely had some hot days mixed in amongst it, but not the endless heat that we can get during the build-up or this time of year in general. At the moment, we've got a ridge across much of the state, and that's driving our short-term weather. But as we go into the back end of the week, we do start to see a trough form across the Northern Territory, and that makes its way into Queensland on around Thursday or Friday. And that's going to be causing that moisture to come into play and drag it further south, leading to that area of showers or maybe even rain at times for some parts of the state as we go into the weekend.
And I know there was some October rainfall records. Is there any indication if November will be sort of heading that direction as well? Like, will we have quite a rainy November?
Probably a bit early to call any sort of rainfall records from the data we've got in front of us right now for the rest of November. But there is a decent signal for the rest into this weekend, let's say, is probably the better way to put it. And that's sets us up going into the back half of the month to have some rainfall totals in the gauges. There is still some potential in the outlook for an above average end to November as well, but it is a bit more hit and miss where exactly where that modelling is putting it.
Baden, thank you so much for your time today.
That's all good. Have a good afternoon.
You too. Baden Gilbert, Senior Forecaster at the Bureau of Meteorology.
Rushes in and bowls it. Yorker and bowls it.
ABC Sports Summer of Cricket on your radio and on the ABC Listen app.
You're listening to the Queensland Country Hour on your radio, online and on the ABC Listen app.
Just before I get into my next story now, a reminder that a local fire ban remains in place for the Whitsundays Council area today. All other local fire bans have now been cancelled. During fire bans, you are not allowed to light any fires in the open, but there are some exceptions. For more details about what you can and can't do during a fire ban, head to the Queensland Fire Department website, which is fire.qld.gov.au. That is fire.qld.gov.au.
You're listening to the Queensland Country Hour on your radio, online and on the ABC Listen app.
The grains industry could reduce its global warming emissions by half if it uses enhanced or coated fertilisers. But there are still some pretty big questions about the cost of these and which ones are actually effective. So farmers apply nitrogen fertilisers to the soil to spur growth in crops, but about half of that nitrogen actually escapes into the atmosphere, and it's known as nitrous oxide. It can also leach into the water table, which can cause some pretty big environmental problems. Helen Souter is a professor of soil science at the University of Melbourne, and David Claughton spoke to her about the different kinds of enhanced fertilisers.
We have essentially three different types of compounds that we can use to alter how nitrogen is released and from a fertiliser and used by the plant. The first one is we coat it with something that will slow the release of the nutrient. The second one is we use an inhibitor, which inhibits the biological processes in the soil that are converting the nitrogen from a form that's not readily lost to a form that could be readily lost. We slow that so that the chances of the plant taking it up are much higher. And there's two of those. One is a nitrification inhibitor. That one's targeting nitrous oxide emissions. The other one is a urease inhibitor, and that one targets ammonia losses from surface applied granular fertilizer. And then you can have those two inhibitor products together. So in our smart fertilizer hub, we're working on developing new types of those products. We're also looking at the options for modifying the soil plant biome to see if we can improve efficiencies of nitrogen use in that space as well.
Sounds fascinating. Now, Professor Peter Grace was telling us that there actually are problems for farmers. The take-up's very low, he thinks below 5%. And here's him explaining why farmers aren't getting a yield boost from these kinds of enhanced fertilisers that they might from other things.
The reason why is obviously production and profitability. I mean, and I'm.
You mean it costs too much?
It costs too much, and it's not being demonstrated that if you put that on, you're getting the same yield as you would if you use regular fertilizers like urea, UAN, other nitrogen fertilizers. So that yield boost, which is what the farmer really wants to see, is not being demonstrated.
So how do you get over that problem, Professor Suter? They're not seeing that boost.
So I suppose there's a couple of things there. So the yield is definitely an issue because, as Peter mentioned, these things obviously cost more because you're adding something onto the fertiliser. And so depending on the product, so if we just talk about the ones that are targeting the N2O emissions, in an ideal world, what we would do is we would prevent the losses occurring by using the product. And that way we could apply less nitrogen. And that way there would be a cost saving. Because even though you're paying more per unit of product, you don't have to put as many units of the nitrogen out because you'd get the same yield at a lower application rate, if that makes sense.
Yep.
In Australia, results from that are quite variable. There's a couple of global meta-analysis studies where they bring together all the data from all the research that's happened around the world. Some of them say that you can get a yield benefit. Others say that you can't.
Is there clear guidance you can give farmers then around these enhanced forms of fertiliser? Like, are they worth it from an economic perspective and a yield perspective?
So if we look at the nitrification inhibitors, at the moment that's challenging in terms of the, you know, a yield benefit, and also if they're costing more, that's an issue. The value of the additional cost is going to depend on the price of urea. So we've seen a fair few fluctuations of urea prices recently. We have got evidence that actually sometimes the nitrogen is being saved in the soil more from using these products. So we want to investigate more about, is that going to improve the soil nitrogen reserves over time? But at the moment for the nitrification inhibitors, it is challenging to recommend those. And what I guess what we'd ask farmers to think about is the potential for regulation and carbon.
Well, they might be forced to reduce emissions, and this might be the only way.
Yeah, that's possible.
So the farmers could get paid effectively or have a credit that they could use to get into certain markets if they that's use right. these fertilisers. Now, Professor Grace also was saying that there's only one product that's consistently reducing emissions or range of products. Here's what he said about that.
There's only probably one product that's really been very consistent. These other products coming through aren't quite like that at the moment.
Can you name the product that's working?
I will not name the product that it's working, I'm sorry.
So,
and I'm happy for people to
look
find
it out.
That. But this is all peer-reviewed public information. It's in a paper that I published back in soil research a number of years ago.
So still, what can you tell us about that? Because he obviously didn't want to, you know, put his name against things and that would be endorsing particular products. But what can you say about, you know, what things are actually working consistently to reduce emissions?
Well, I'm not going to name products. And there's quite a bit of confusion, I think, in the farming community about the different types of inhibitors. So I mentioned there's a nitrification inhibitor, targets N2O loss. There's also a urease inhibitor on the market, and that inhibitor actually targets ammonia volatilization. And so that's a very different story, and that actually, the urease inhibitor, which is targeting ammonia loss, because ammonia loss can be quite large, we've measured up to 30% of ryegrass systems, and that inhibitor works very effectively in reducing that. So the savings in nitrogen are quite big, so therefore there is the potential to get a yield benefit. There are countries in Europe where you must use that product if you're going to surface apply granular urea, and the costs are much more favourable. That is a cheaper additive on the fertiliser.
Helen Suter is a professor of soil science at the University of Melbourne. She was speaking there to David Claughton, but you also would have heard from Peter Grace, who is the professor of the global change at the Queensland University of Technology. It is 11 minutes to one. Up next, there's a couple
in northern New South Wales who are doing some pretty interesting things on their farm. Some may even say that's eclectic, the combination of livestock and crops that they are producing. That's up next.
Worms, slime, and the secrets of the plant world.
Foster!
The Gardening Australia Junior podcast has brand new adventures for little ears.
Cool.
Search for it now on the ABC Listen app.
You're listening to the Queensland Country Hour on your radio, online, and on the ABC Listen app.
I'll take you to markets shortly, but first, just over the border in northern New South Wales, when an Australian man working in finance randomly met the love of his life on a beach in South Africa. His future wife had no idea where their relationship would lead them. Jennifer Nichols spoke to the couple 6 years after they founded one of the most eclectic farms you could imagine near Byron Bay in northern New South Wales.
My name is Tom Bjorkson from Misty Creek Agroforestry. We have a certified organic mixed farm based around Syntropic Agroforestry near Byron Bay in New South Wales, where we produce meat chickens, eggs, beef, Brussels sprouts and kiwi fruit.
Wow, what a mix. And this is your wife, Nicole. So how much land do you have?
28 acres.
So I come from a farming family. I'm a fourth generation farmer, but a very different style of farming. So the farm I grew up on, about 7,500 acres, central west of New South Wales, beef farm. And yeah, so Nicole's, we actually met when I was travelling through Africa. So.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I'm from Cape Town. Met Tom randomly on the beach, bit of fate there. I'm definitely not a farmer, but I feel like I've been broken in after a few years and I've earned my stripes, I guess. So yeah, we've been there for about 6 years now and yeah, it's been amazing.
Did you buy land?
Yeah, we bought that in 2019. So yeah, we both had different backgrounds, but even though they were unrelated to farming, you know, from her growing up in Cape Town, that actually was really important when you're setting up a farm that's more than just a farm. It's also a business as well, and we're selling the product straight to consumers.
And do you handle social media side of things?
So Tom's the face of the farm and I do all the editing and posting and stuff like that. So Tom's background is in finance and mine's in graphic design. So together we were able to create a really beautiful brand, which I think was really important to get us out there.
And so if we come to your farm, there's a lot going on.
Yeah, absolutely. And you kind of need to on such a small farm. But when you run all these things together, they have really beautiful feedback loops with each other. So the chickens grow better pasture for the cows. The cows make the pasture more palatable for the chickens. And both of them providing a lot of fertility for the vegetables and the trees to grow as well. None of them are mutually exclusive on the farm. They're all integrated with each other. And that way they're benefiting each other as well.
How many years did it take for you to start making a profit?
How many years, Tom?
Probably about now, really, like about 6 years, you
know. Yeah, that's a long haul then, isn't it?
Like yes and no, because we were making money but then reinvesting it back to grow. And it's always like reinvesting and reinvesting. And now we've kind of got to a point where it's like, okay, we've got to a stage where we're happy with what we're doing and now it's about becoming a bit more efficient and also striking a bit of a balance with a new family into the business.
Yeah, you've got your up right here.
I was going to say, in the beginning, it was just Tom and I working for, what, 3 years or so?
About 2 years.
2 years. Now we actually employ other people. We get to have a bit of holiday. I'm able to take maternity leave. So even though maybe we took a while to make a profit, yeah, now we're actually able to employ local people and take a weekend off, which was not possible before.
That's awesome. Yeah. And it's really good for your mental health as well.
Absolutely, yeah. Funnily enough, I've had people ask me, I say, how do you look better now that you're a dad than you did before? And it's because I've been taking 2 days off a week.
Tell me about the tree side of what you do.
Yep, so we're practicing syntropic agroforestry. Basically, that's looking at the process of natural succession and how ecosystems develop over time. And by respecting this process, basically means we can farm without needing any inputs. So we don't need fertilizer, we don't need compost, and we certainly don't need chemicals or any synthetic fertilizers or things like this.
So what did you plant and how did you plant it?
We'll have a couple of target species. So it might be mulberries for the animals and casuarina for long-term timber. But then we're also planting dozens and dozens of support species with those as well. So those support species, they bring biodiversity their biomass gets returned to the ground through pruning, and they're, alongside those other things, their root exudates are building long-term carbon. So,
what are we talking about? Arrowroot, yes. Bananas?
Yeah. So arrowroot, bananas, pigeon pea, cassava, eucalyptus is a big one for us. We use acacias, wattles.
And do you chop and drop them?
I would say it's somewhat more intentional than chop and drop, but that's an easy way to describe it.
What would your advice be to others who might be interested in regenerative agriculture?
I think gain as much experience as you can in various different farms before diving in headfirst on your own. Don't necessarily have to all be regenerative agriculture farms too. There's a lot to learn from all different types of farms. They all have different lessons to teach, and the more broad experience you can have with farming production systems and just how the whole food production and distribution and selling system works, then the more chance you have of success.
And with your operation, is it the eggs that are the most profitable?
Probably right now, so 50% meat chickens, 40% eggs, and about 10% the Brussels sprouts. But within the next year, that'll be more like 25% on the cattle, 25% on the chicken, 25% on the eggs, 25% on the Brussels sprouts and kiwi fruit.
And I'm trying to convince Tom to do some more educational things as well, but he just said he needed to have more experience first.
It can be fairly common that small-scale farms can't make a go of primary production, so instead they turn to workshops and education and tours, but without really having the real world examples or the success behind them. So I wanted to make sure that I could prove that what we did worked before I kind of had the credentials to tell other people how to do it.
Tom and Nicole Bjorkston from Misty Creek Agroforestry near Byron Bay speaking to Jennifer Nichols. And what an interesting combo of things that they are producing on their farm. Markets are up next. First up, let's cross to the Roma store sale with David Friend.
The scattered showers are very welcome storms. Roma agents yarded 6,125 head. All the regular buyers attending. Cattle were drawn from the normal supply district, a quality yard of cattle pen that runs off vendor bred lines. At the time of this interim report, market stronger for all categories. Yearling steers 200 to 280 kilos, top to 570 cents a kilo. Yearling steers 280 to 330 kilos, off from 450 to 556 cents a kilo. Yearling steers 330 to 400 made from 450 to 540 cents a kilo. Yearling steers 400 to 480 kilos to 486 to lot feeders and 526 cents to restockers. Yearling steers over 480 kilos sold to 590 cents a kilo to lot feeders. Growing steers 400 to 500 kilos made to 508 to lot feeders. Growing steers 500 to 600 kilos to 456 to processors. Growing steers over 600 kilos to 456 to processors as well. A large number of young bulls penned selling to 495 under 450 kilos. Bulls over 600 kilos to 410. This has been David Fenn from the National Livestock Reporting Service at Roma.
Meanwhile, Errol Luck is watching the prices at the Warwick sale yards today.
Good afternoon. Warwick Days has been 1,499 head of mainly well-finished heifer export and feeder lines with a balanced quality yearling cattle. The buying lineup included an extra southern processor which resulted in bullocks and heavy cows selling to dearer trends and increased numbers of heavy feeder cattle also sold to dearer rates. At the time this interim report, yearling steers in the 280 range to restockers sold to 538, yearling steers over 280 to background sold to 526, and yearling steers to feed the domestic market made to 526 to average 494. Heavy yearling steers to feed sold to 500 and averaged from 481 to 494. Yearling heifers in the 280 to 330 range to feed sold to 446. Medium weight yearling heifers to feed sold to 442 to average 396. Heavy yearling heifers to feed sold to 426. And heavy yearling heifers to processors sold to 461 to average from 423 to 433. Bullocks to processors made 487 to average 470. Grown heifers to processors sold to 454. Lightweight plain conditioned cows to processors made 377 and heavy score 3 cows to processors made 402 to average 380. The best of heavy cows topping at 423 to average 402. Heavy bulls topped at 431. This has been Errol Luck, MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thank you for your company on the Country Hour today. Just want to flag something ahead of tomorrow's show. So agriculture is actually going to be a key focus at the COP30 conference in Brazil over the next 10 days.
A coalition has launched the COP30 declaration to reform agri-food systems, urging global leaders to tackle emissions, biodiversity loss and the destruction of habitat while also protecting food production. And I'm going to bring you more details on that conference in tomorrow's show. And also on tomorrow's show, there's a new mango variety hitting supermarket shelves that has been grown here in Queensland. I'll bring you all those details. So tune in from midday on ABC Radio Queensland or on the ABC Listen app. News time now. It's 1 o'clock.